Hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Listening Behind the Curtain, our opportunity to step into the world of theater and the arts. And on this show, we're stepping into probably one of the most maybe important plays ever written. That's a pretty dramatic thing to say when you have folks like Shakespeare out there in the past. But the truth is that this play is incredibly powerful. It is called Angels in America. It was produced on Broadway back in the 90s, where it won all sorts of awards and Tony Awards. It comes back every period of years. I saw a recent redo on Broadway with Nathan Lane and Andrew Garfield, and it's just, well, now Invictus Theater Company in Chicago has taken on this challenge, and it's a big one. Joining me is a lot of the cast of the show and also the director and artistic director of Invictus Theater Company. I'm going to introduce you, but I'm going to take it one by one because I want you to talk about your characters. Charles Askenizer, I'm going to start with you as the director. I'm going to put you in your director role for this show. For folks who aren't familiar with Angels in America, they probably heard of it, but maybe don't. Without telling me about the characters, because they're here, what is this show all about? And by the way, as a director, why did you pick this show to do?
Yeah, well, like you said, Paul, I mean, it is probably one of the most important plays that's been written, and probably the greatest American play that has been written as well. So it was kind of a no-brainer to put it on and direct it, and especially given our current times as well. It's set in the 80s. You know, it's actually, we have a lot of people asking, you know, what is the show about? And it's kind of challenging because it's so big. It's 7-hour sprawl. But Tony Kushner, his superlative title for it is A Gay Fantasia on National Themes. And then really, really distill down the plot. And I mean, really distill it. It's about a gay man in New York City in the 80s who contracts AIDS and his journey experiencing that. So again, it's a huge distillation of the plot. But
and by the way, you said 7 hours. For those who are in panic saying, I got to sit there for 7 hours. Well, you could. I did. But you don't have to. How can they see it, Charles, in not a 7-hour stint?
Yeah. So we break it up. So part one is Friday nights, and then also Saturday matinees is part one. Saturday evening is part two. Sunday matinees are part two, and then we alternate every other Monday as well. And they go by very, very quickly, too. One of the biggest comments we've gotten from people is, wow, that felt like 10 minutes watching a 7-hour show.
So, and they also have different names for each part. Part one is called?
Millennium Approaches, and then part two is Perestroika.
I've had some people say, you know, you really could just see one part without the other. I mean, I guess you could. I don't think you should because, well, actually, one more question, Charles. I mean, each one, there is like a separate theme and thing going on in part one versus part two, right? I mean, part one, we get a lot of character information, and part two, things seem to go more global.
Yeah. Even Tony Kushner himself, he talks about part one and even the structure of the play. So part one, Millennium Approaches, is, I'd say, more politically focused. It is a tighter play, whereas Perestroika is more expansive. It's more poetic. It's a little messier. He won the Pulitzer for part one, but part two he won the Tony Award for, as well as part one. And Perestroika, of course, is the thaw, the reconstruction. So there's the destruction of the angel entering at the end of part one. Sorry, bit of a spoiler alert. And then part two is the rebuilding after that.
Let's meet the characters. And since you sort of said that you put a primary focus on somebody who is dealing with a battle with AIDS, so I'm going to go to that character, and that's Pryor Walter. So Brendan Zwiebel, who joins us. Now, you're an understudy for that role, but you join us today. By the way, your background is fascinating to me, aside from being in Normal Heart, which you did at Red Twist, so you get this kind of thematic thing going on in a show like that. And I don't know if your fellow castmates know this, you have a black belt in Taekwondo, so I'm not messing with you.
Yes, I do. Watch out.
Tell me about Pryor Walter.
Yeah, Pryor, he's a gay man living in New York City, you know, in the 1980s, and he gets his whole world rocked when he gets diagnosed with AIDS during the HIV/AIDS crisis. And then on top of that, he has you know, relationship issues that he's dealing with, and then a voice that just pops into his head, which turns out to be, I guess, spoiler alert, an angel. And then, without giving too much away, he has to deal with just all of the pain and the mysticism and humor of the journey that he goes on throughout the whole play.
And he goes through this with his loving, supportive partner. Yes, or maybe that's
sarcasm.
A little sarcasm.
Yes.
I love it. It's a character of Lewis Ironson, played by Hugh Grant character. And you, by the way, not only an actor, you're a playwright, you're a director, and you're no stranger to Tony Kushner's work, which is I think really important in this role. Tell me about Lewis. I love that character, and I love the way you portray him.
Thank you. I love Lewis so much. I have since I first encountered this piece in high school. Like, I don't know what it was, but I was just like, that's the person I empathize with greatly and like who I feel for. He is a young Jewish man, 32 years old. He has a terrible amount of gall and nerve and very little backbone. And he has a huge mind that's processing so many things at once. And a big heart that he's, I think, very scared to have broken. And when he learns that his boyfriend is going to die, he does his best to be there for him until he realizes that staying just might kill him. So he decides to leave.
And that grown up Jewish neurosis thing, that's my background. So I got to tell you, if you have any questions, call me. little late now. The show's been playing for quite a while. And then let's go to the flip side of this as I decide where to go next. And I'm going to go to the character of Joe Pitt, because you have a lot of challenges, Joe Bushell, as you play this role. But I love about this in your role, and it kind of fits the Joe Pitt thing, your actual background, you're this sort of musical guy, Dames at Sea. And I know you're very active in Jeff Daniels, who I've interviewed in Michigan, his theater company, where you're a playwright and ensemble member. So if anything, I don't know, I see like this sort of happy-go-lucky real guy, Joe Bushell, and then taking on this role, which is just sort of forcing you to deal with things and face life that you're like, I don't want to be that person.
Right. Yeah. Joe's very interesting character. There's two parts of him, I would say. And like you said, the dichotomy of my personal, I guess, self versus Joe. Joe's essentially starting the play wearing a mask, where he grew up as a Mormon. He grew up to become a lawyer and a Republican lawyer. But this whole time, he's known that he is a homosexual, but he's never told anybody. He keeps it very close to the chest, even though those closest to him, like his wife Harper, have a sneaking suspicion that that's the case. So really you get to see the journey of Joe confront that secret part of himself, even if it's not by choice originally. And then as you expand into Perestroika, his whole life starts to somewhat unravel, first in some good ways when he meets Lewis, but then by the end, not going to give anything away, but it's just him dealing with the consequences of living kind of within shame his whole life and what that brings about if you leave it that way.
Now, you've allowed me to go two ways. You talked about him being a Republican lawyer keeping a secret. We're not going to talk politics here because that would never happen in the real world. But I'm going to take it in another direction, which is the world of your wife, because she's with us too. And so Harper Pitt, played by Ann Trodden, and Ann, what I love, they should change the name of the Invictus Theater to the Ann Theater, because you were the Faye Dunaway role in Network, Diana, and you've done so much stuff at Invictus, which means that Charles, who does a lot of this casting, loves you. Tell me about Harper.
Well, I sure hope so. Harper is, she is married to Joe. She's also raised in this very traditional, like conservative Mormon background. And I think her big journey is, just discovering herself and who she is, and confronting things she's also trying to like hide from. Well, like while Joe is trying to hide from, reality, so is Harper in a way. And for her, the play is really about her kind of finding herself.
And then let's go to that Republican idea. What I find really interesting, and I'm coming to you, Shane Robrey, you are ready for the role of Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn is a guy. In fact, he was Donald Trump's lawyer, and Donald Trump keeps, you know, when he was having his legal troubles, he was like, where's my Roy Cohn? And some people, it's a disconnect because Roy Cohn feels like he was a forever ago. He wasn't that long ago.
No.
But tell me about Roy Cohn, because you are one of the real people in this show.
Yeah, Roy Cohn, him. Born and raised in the Bronx of a Jewish family. His father was also a district attorney and in the Bronx. And Roy Cohn is most notably known for his involvement in the Rosenberg trials with Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and convicting them for being traitors and spies for Russia. So he's most known for that. Most people would look at him as a pretty bad guy. We talk about what kind of trauma must have happened to have him get to that point, and what stakes were there for him to be the way that he was. I mean, he wasn't a good guy. And he kind of admits it a lot, but yeah.
By the way, just since you of the group here, you're the one playing the real character. There's Ethel Rosenberg. She shows up in the show, but not with us today. What did you do homework? Did you do some homework to find out, like, who is this Roy Cohn guy? And like,
yeah,
basically, I want to be Roy on stage.
Of course. I mean, it's hard to say, oh, I want to play Roy Cohn, because people go, I think it's because he's such a bad guy. And, you know, people would say that he's evil and he's the villain. And it's like, you know, when I read this play a long time ago, I said, I'm going to play this part. I want to play this part. And I think it's kind of weird to say that because why would you want to play somebody like this? But I think a lot of actors will tell you this, you know, when you approach a character like this, you know, a villain or somebody that's evil, it's like you kind of have to love the character. You have to find why he is the way that he is and latch on to that. And, you know, it's never an attempt to be like, oh, he was a good guy and this happened to him. That's not the case. But to truly play someone who was fighting for something, you know, he was fighting for, he was protecting himself most of the time. So I think that's
listen, right. I just want to add, we also say yeah. though, we think that Joe Pitt is actually the real villain amongst the cast.
Sure.
He might be the actual, like, real villain of this show. But I encourage people to go see and decide for themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Charles, as the director and the person kind of responsible for this show happening at Invictus, let me ask you this. To me, a very powerful line in the show is the line that says the world only spins forward. And it's always made me wonder, who are we? Who are we as a country? So you have this show that is giving us life in the 80s and a little early 90s, and yet we're living this life today. You can't walk out and not think about its impact today. So what does the phrase "the world only spins forward" mean to you as you directed this show?
Oh, wow. Jeez. Easy question, Paul.
What do you mean to do?
You know, I think that this play, the overall thing of it is hopeful. You know, when we first proposed it 2 years ago, when I first proposed it to the board, you know, I had some board members that were trepidatious about it because they're like, oh, it's a play about AIDS. You know, there's so much suffering and disease. But I think the world only spins forward. And what I think Tony Kushner is going for is that, and especially putting in that in the context of that final speech, is that there will be struggle, there will be hardship, but ultimately we will progress forward. The world spins forward, and you know, we may have difficult or dark times, but we will get through it. And so the play itself is very hopeful and looking at a very positive view of the future. So that's what it means to me, without diving into all of my, you know, political views and whatnot. But that's what I think Tony Kushner is getting at as well, too.
Yeah. Grant, talk to me a little bit about the journey of Lewis. You know, in the second part of the show and even the end of the show, where we get some speechifying going on about what the world is dealing with at that time. And Tony Kushner wrote this back, you know, in that period of time. So here we are more than 25 years later addressing this. When you speak your lines and talk about that period of time, do you sit there and say, this feels dated to me? Or do you speak it with a mind towards today? And where would Lewis be today, I wonder? He could be around.
Oh, yes. I'm sure he's campaigning for some Democrat that he loves a lot. And I'm sure he's at the front of most of the picket lines against Trump. No, it never feels dated. As it goes on, this run, I just find new ways that it's relevant. Like this speech I have with Joe in the first show during our hot dog scene, where I talk about, like, you know, he's had a dream that the whole Hall of Justice is empty. It's deserted, and that maybe we're in a land of lawlessness. And I say, maybe the courts won't convene, and we really are free to do whatever, children of the new morning. And we're Reagan's children. And I think that really clicked with me a few weeks ago, where I was like, you know, we are kind of living in a country run by the children of Reagan's philosophies, mm-hmm. and which are all based in tradition and values that are embraced by a certain sect of the American population, but not all the American population. And so when I hear things like the world only spins forward, even though I don't say it, that's one that really hits me, because as we are dealing with this stupid MAGA nonsense about hearkening back to more traditional times, I think what Tony is trying to say there is that the world will progress. And there's no use in trying to hold us back. We don't know what the progress will bring, but we can't let that lack of knowledge stop us. We have to keep going forward.
By the way, your last comment there sends me to Joe, because Joe, do you think that your character, Joe, I don't know if that was part of you getting the role, you got to be named Joe, but would Joe Pitt be MAGA today? Is he Mitt Romney? Would he have left the party? Where is Joe?
That's a very good point that you just made yourself. Right when you said that, I was like, no, I think he's more of kind of like the Mitt Romney school, where he does have values that he grew up with that I think he holds on to strongly, that I don't think would align with the MAGA movement today. So I do not think he would be in that realm. And also, I mean, if we're thinking about this just in terms of like his arc, I do think he becomes a different person by the end. He's in a kind of a shattered state, but I do think he's somebody who realized some of the errors of his ways and thinking towards the end, even if he hasn't put that together in a coherent framework for himself. But yeah, I do think he holds on to just personal decency, I think, strongly, which is something I feel like that's been missing from the political conversation. Just a basic respect of even somebody who's a different ideology than you. So yeah, that's where I think he would land.
And you know, it's interesting to take that. I'm going to break it up in a couple of parts. Let me start with your wife by going to Anne and asking Harper this. I mean, it looks like Harper is not so wrapped up in all the political stuff that is going on. You're hearing the comments from Grant and other people, and this show is a very political show. Kushner wants it to be. I don't think Harper is, that's not what she's about. It's about her, she has a relationship to deal with.
I would actually kind of disagree with you there.
Go for it.
Yeah. I think all of Tony's characters are political. And I think we have an argument in part one of Millennium Approaches. Joe Pitt is trying to convince Harper that Reagan's making the world better for us. And Harper comes back at him and says, no, he's not. The world is just as bad as it always was. It's just, you know, Reagan is trying to paint it over that things are better and they're not. So I would push back, and then I would say she probably wouldn't express it outwardly at that time, but I would say she lands in the more liberal side. She's just sort of trapped in the kind of time period and role that she's in. And like by the end of it, I would say she's like fully like liberal and embracing herself. And I think it's always there, but it's just she doesn't know what to do with it, or she doesn't know how to fight back with or push out of that until the end of the play.
Brendan, it also seems to me, I could be wrong on this too, but you get the feeling that Pryor, whereas other people are trying to control their world, certainly, you know, the lawyers are trying to control the world. But it would seem to me, it's like the world is happening to Pryor.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. The world is happening to Pryor and more, it seems like. It's just everything is crashing down on Pryor over and over and over again, with just no break in between. But he just like continues to just fight and fight and fight and chooses to live, which is like something that I admire so much about Pryor himself. It's beautiful.
Shane is, by the way, is Roy. He does a few things that are pretty despicable in the show. It has to do with, these are the early days of AIDS. There's AZT treatments. There's those kinds of things. And Roy Cohn, you already said this, far more concerned about himself than he is about the rest of the planet. Does he go through any metamorphosis by the end of this show? Because by the way, at the end of the show, I mean, well, we know he's gone because he's gone, but does he go through a metamorphosis?
I'm not sure he goes through a huge arc. No, I think he acknowledges what who he is and what he's done, but he's very unapologetic for it. I think that might be his arc, is that he knows he's a bad guy. He's doing what he has to do. We often in rehearsal compared to him like some animal, some feral animal, like that's backed into a corner and doing whatever he needs to do to get by, to maintain his status. And so yeah, I think that it's hard to say.
Well, one
I
thing is
don't,
true about
yeah.
your character. He has no self-doubt, right?
He does not doubt any move he makes. He, and in fact, it's also mentioned in the play that, the consequences are much easier to deal with after the fact. Like, do what you got to do, and we'll deal with whatever we need to afterwards. I mean, he's got so much stuff on other people that he's not ever worried about the decision he makes, and it's always for his benefit.
By the way, by word of history, Charles, Invictus Theater Company, just these last few years that you moved into Windy City Playhouse territory, it's like everybody's found you, but you've been around for quite a while.
Yeah, we are 8 years old. We're going into our ninth year in January. We are getting on to the pre-adolescent stages.
And
am I right? Every season, people, because I know you love Shakespeare, every season, people will see Shakespeare at Invictus.
Correct. Yes, we so when I program our season, I pick the Shakespeare show and then I pull themes from that and pair contemporary plays with it, or more contemporary plays. They don't have to be contemporary plays. It could be a bunch of classical plays too. But yeah.
But when you pick plays like Network and or Angels in America, it seemed to me, I have this theory that when a theater company has like its mission and this is the kind of thing we do, it also it's like the Lyric Opera Theater. They do opera, but it's amazing how every year they went, except let's do West Side Story. Except we're going to throw Fiddler in here this season. I have an idea, Mary Poppins movie with the orchestra. And I'm saying that because that show is coming up on Broadway, on Backstage. Sorry, I'm behind the curtain soon. But do you sort of say, we've got the season, we're doing Shakespeare, but you know what? Network is going to bring them in. Angels in America is bringing them in. Is that part of, I mean, you're artistic director, you got to be thinking that way.
Yes, I mean, ticket sales are always like foremost on my mind, and like, how do we bring in patrons and money and whatnot. However, Angels in America is on par with Shakespeare, I would say, in terms of the language, and same with Network too. I mean, it is Shakespearean, so it fits very well into our mission. So if I can match what's going to bring people in and what's going to fit our mission statement, then I'm a happy camper.
Let's go back and talk about some of the themes of the show. Grant, you talked about how your character again grew up Jewish. That puts the parents in my head and all that sort of stuff. Does Grant always know who he is? Does he? I mean, clearly he's out and stuff by the end of the show, but I almost feel like there's a backstory to him that has occurred before this show before the play itself starts.
I think you said, does Grant always know who he
Sorry,
is?
I'm yes,
I was like,
let's not talk about Grant.
no.
Let's move it into your character, of course, Lewis.
He doesn't. Neither of them
Well,
do.
Grant or Lewis, neither of them have that answer.
Yeah. I think Lewis has a very large wealth of self-knowledge. He knows what he is capable of and what he is not. And he's also terribly intelligent. I just think he might not have best perspective on things all the time. And that's the arc, is coming outside himself, I think. Going from, I can't watch my boyfriend die because it will shatter me, to, well, I don't really care if I have to watch him die because I need and want him in my life. And if watching him die means I get to be with him for the rest of his life, I will do it. It's not so much about like some sort of gaining of self-knowledge and more of just like thinking about other people a bit more.
I'll come to you, Brennan, for the Pryor mm-hmm. part of that. Is Pryor a good match with Lewis? I mean, you know, as I kind of watch the relationship, I kind of watch what would this couple actually be together, or are they two different worlds who both of whom are gay, whatever, they found each other. It's back in the 80s. I don't know. Is it a true love affair in your view?
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Grant, but I would say, yeah, I think that they could be together. They have like so many opposites that, I mean, Pryor even talks about how much he loves just seeing Lewis just kind of be himself. Yeah, just everything. Like it's they really do feel like they're meant for one another. And it could be two lines being parallel, could be two lines crossing, or two lines eventually going away. And it's just a very unfortunate time period for both of them, and extenuating circumstances, to say the least.
Yeah, I don't know what it is that makes them work.
Yeah,
but they do work. If they weren't put to this test, I think they would have gone on living together till they were two old biddies.
Oh, okay. So yeah, they would not have split up. Joe, what about Harper and Joe? Did he love Harper? Did he want to be married? Is this a relationship he wanted? Or did he find that because of his challenges, it's just something you had to do?
I'm going to take a cop out. It's a little bit of both. So I think for Joe, obviously for Harper, there was never the kind of sexual attraction, romantic in that way. But I do think that him and Harper do share a very deep connection in terms of kind of Joe talks about at one point how Harper is always doing something wrong, and kind of she was a bit of an outcast in Salt Lake City where they grew up. And I do think Joe felt that way internally, even if he kind of checked all the boxes externally. So I think that they could have been extremely close, maybe best friends, if Joe had come out early on in life and kind of explored who he was. But I do think that they did get married because Joe saw that that was his duty, was to get married, start a family, have many kids. And he thought that Harper would be the best person to do that with.
And Anne, your thought as Harper?
Yeah, you know, the more I do this show, I realize, like, I think that Joe and Harper share a sense of humor, and I think that's what really, like, brought them together, and I think that's what's kind of, like, tragic as it keeps going on, is, like, I think they would have been, if Joe Pitt had just, you know, been able to come out, they could have been, like, incredibly close friends. It's just, unfortunately, she developed feelings because she didn't know there wasn't that kind of reciprocal attraction. So, and to me, it's just like their friendship and their sense of humor probably really brought them together in the beginning. It's just unfortunate. It's just the unfortunate situation of he was gay. He doesn't have any sexual feelings for her.
Do you see Harper as strong in character or weak? I don't mean that in a bad way, but just strong or weak, Harper?
I always think of this book, this quote from this book, and I can't remember the name of it, but the quote is, that which yields is not always weak. And that's what I think of with Harper. She yields all the time. She's constantly like kind of bending to her circumstances and trying to make it work, but she never actually breaks. She gets very, very close, but she always like kind of comes back. And by the end of it, that's what she's like a master of, is like sort of being in that sort of flow state and being able to kind of like adjust to what's going on and not breaking and shattering.
And Shane, I just want to ask you, I think you mentioned, and I also mentioned it, this notion of Julius Ethel Rosenberg. Certainly Ethel Rosenberg, I said she's in the show. For people watching us who have never seen Angels in America, they might be going, what? Can you just kind of explain, again, your character is real, and Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, they were real. Why do you think they're coming up in this show?
I think because it's what put Roy on the map, in a sense, that it was his pivotal moment in his career that made him who he is. It was such a huge case, and there was never any real evidence behind it, behind them being convicted. They didn't have it, technically nowadays, what would be strong enough evidence to convict them to be electrocuted? I mean, he says it in the play. He's like, they almost got life, and for whatever reason, he has his reasons, but he wanted them. He needed to prove a point that he could get this done, and it was a manner of showing the world who he is. And I think,
and pointing to historical figures, which, by the way, to this day, I mean, the truth is we don't know whether there's lots of evidence that suggests they did not. They weren't traitors to the country, and there's still those who say no, yes, they were. I guess we may never know. Yeah. So, Charles, in always wanting to come to you with the easy questions, I'm curious. When people sit through the show, I mean, I find the themes of the show are incredibly complex. Tony Kushner is incredibly complex. Do people who watch this show at the level of character, as I've been asking you about character and that sort of thing, would you say, yeah, that's fine, get the character experience out of it? Or do you want people to connect with a deep dive into Kushner's sort of commentary on political, social forces?
Oh, the latter. I mean, I would love for both to happen. And the thing that makes Kushner such a good writer, is he has these complex ideas and thoughts and themes that he's able to package them really, really well. And if you look at the structure of his scenes too, I mean, he will come at you with these big, heady ideas, but then he'll couch it with humor, or he'll have some sort of dramatic moment happen, such as an angel popping up, or people making love, or you know, violence of some kind. And so he's constantly keeping your attention while he's feeding you this material. So I that's his brilliance, I think, in that it's both. I want people to walk away with both. I want their head to be full, but their heart to be just as full as well.
Yeah, I think it's probably why you got a Pulitzer Prize for this, right? It goes deeper than the characters. So I know you all had the opportunity with my friend Chris Jones to talk to Kushner one evening. This may or may not have come up, but Grant, I'm going to ask you. My view has always been that if Kushner can be identified in one of the characters, it's Lewis. That's kind of from my interaction with him, maybe. But you may know. So you probably all know. But let me ask you, are you Tony Kushner in this show?
I mean, that was actually something that came up in our conversation. Tony said that he always thought that Lewis, the actor, should be probably hotter than him. So,
that's why Charles cast you.
Nice pat on the back moment. I mean, listen to one 10-minute clip of a Tony Kushner interview and you will learn he is very similar to Lewis. Mm-hmm. Every response to a question comes with like 14 amendments and 90 commas,
yes,
and ellipses and only a few periods.
Yes.
But it's always so, like, I could listen to him talk for 15 hours, and I feel like some people feel similarly about Lewis. I know there's some characters who would prefer him to just shut up. But, yeah, of course, he's very similar to Tony. And I think Tony's pretty aware that, like, he's using Lewis as a funnel and a channel for a lot of his political ideas that he needs to get out but doesn't know where to put them.
I think even Chris Jones said, like, it's really like Lewis and Blease. Blease, mm-hmm, tends to be like the sort of heart, like that hopefulness, that optimism, the world only spins forward. That's Tony as well. And that's the other half of him, he would say, is that Blease is sort of that optimistic, hopeful half. And I would say Lewis is more of that cynical, like voracious mind that just won't stop.
I was going to say, I think Kushner's much sweeter than Lewis, but I agree with that very much, Anne.
Okay, let's okay. All right. Crazy.
We're going to make Grant's head way too big. Joe, I'm going to come to you with an unfair question, but I'll ask, anybody can chime in on this. Because I think one of the senses you get out of this show is kind of a Charles question, but I mean, the importance of community is really key. And so when you look at, when I mean community, I mean like today, society and community. And when you look at the way laws are, say same-sex marriage legal today, abortion used to be, legal just a few years ago. A lot of things changed in 2015, 2020, and all that kind of thing. I'm sort of curious. I have this philosophy that you can change laws, but you can't change people's values. And I feel like Joe Pitt is a good person to ask to have talk about that.
Wow. Yes. Thank you for an easy one. I would say Joe almost feels like it shouldn't be that way. I believe, well, in terms of changing the law specifically, where I do think he is a bit of a, to use some, I did a little bit of research. So like I would think he follows textualism where he thinks, and originalism where he thinks that the law should be mostly unchanging throughout time. And that it shouldn't necessarily reflect the changing values of society in that sense. So maybe he does think that values are changing. He does think that the world is swinging more so in his direction of his beliefs during the time period of the play. But I do think there's an argument he has, a very heated argument with Lewis, where he relies on the notion of precedence. So he does not think that the law should necessarily change just based on what the community at large thinks is the right thing to do. It should kind of rely on the history of the past and kind of the collective notion of our, or the collective wisdom of our ancestors. So
Can
that's
I
my go
jump
for
in,
it.
Joe? We were talking earlier about whether or not Joe would be MAGA nowadays, and I don't necessarily disagree. I think it's open to interpretation, but he does have when you were talking about it, he has that line in that same scene where doesn't he say something about its power, not politics, when Lewis is confronting him with these decisions that he's written
It's
for
law
the
and
judge, which
justice.
has had these incredibly negative impacts on people. And I mean, that's sort of what the MAGA movement has become. It's become power over values. So I just throw that out there too, just to add more spice to the soup, because I think it's really, he's like they all are, a very complex, complicated character.
And of course, I hear this. Look, I teach constitutional law. And so part of what goes through my mind as we talk about this, Shane, you're the lawyer. I'll come to you. No. But it is fascinating how an originalist can say things shouldn't change and then read it the way they just choose to read it. But that's a whole nother conversation. But Anne, since you say Harper is a political figure, as all these things, and I don't disagree, but if Joe was coming home from work saying, "Oh, by the way, I'm working on this case today. We're going to remove some more rights from people that got it." Would Harper get involved in that conversation, or would Harper just say, "Well, Joe, that's your job"?
I mean, I think she would want to hear about it. I think she's interested. I just don't, especially at the beginning of the play, I just don't think she would push back very much. She would push back a little bit, and if things got too heated, she would just sort of back off. It would get too scary and overwhelming for her. But I think at the end of part two, she would have different opinions, or she'd be a bit more forceful with it. But I think that seed is there in part one. It's just it takes the whole play for her to realize like who she is and what she believes in, if that makes sense.
I'm gonna let you. I want to let you. Oh, go ahead, Grant. Sure.
I was just also going to add, and I think that Harper's, and you can just tell me if I'm wrong, Anne, but that
She
her
will.
clarity becomes please tell me I'm wrong. I think that Harper's clarity becomes crystallized throughout the show. Like, I think in the beginning, she's still pushing back against Joe, but she's like philosophizing and making things big and poetic. And he's saying to her, like, you're not making any sense. But like for her, she's trying to make so much sense. And I think the clearest cut and dry she is in the show is at the end when she says, no, probably never. That's how bad. Credit card.
Yeah, she does. She, that I mean, but that's like, again, without getting like that's her journey is like at the beginning, she is just she's very cerebral, but like she's cerebral, but she's like feeling cerebral. I don't, it's very hard to like describe. Like to me,
Sure.
Lewis is such like a cerebral character, and like Harper is like it's all heart with her. It's all like it's all emotions, and it's trying to like verbalize emotions, which is why she gets like so poetic.
Well,
So that's why.
she's in touch with some third eye
Yes, and she's very
ish that Lewis is
yes.
not.
That could be the Valium talking, though.
But you know what? Her like lots of people do. I've got ayahuasca and so anyway. But we always say like her and Pryor are the prophets of the show, right? Like it's just to me, Pryor is reaching out to like find the prophecy, and Harper goes in to find the prophecy. Like it's just two different directions. I don't know if that like helps anybody, but that's how I view it. Yeah.
But it does make me want to ask Brendan a prior question, because I said earlier that I feel like Pryor is having the show happen to him as he goes through, and yet there is this spirituality, whatever. I mean, I almost think, let me see what you think about the importance of Pryor. Pryor, I don't know that he starts off as a spiritual guy and all, you know, where, and he's guiding all the, and so he, things happen and we're not sure whether he's seeing it because he's such a religious and spiritual person. It may be other things that are leading to it, but how important is it that Pryor be the one who's, I think, in many ways, whose eyes we are seeing this story through?
Oh gosh, another easy question. I mean, I think Pryor was ran. I don't know. I mean, maybe not randomly picked for a specific reason for sure, for his outlook and how confident he is on in his life, and just he seems to know who he is as a person, but then also doesn't at times. But then he really just makes it a very I you know it's he handles himself in a very specific way, I think, and it really helps give this butterfly effect, maybe unintentionally, to the other characters in the show as well, with his decisions and his reactions to specific things, I would say.
And let me just, I'm curious, Charles, should Charles Kushner write a part three to Angels in America? And you can all chime in on this, but what I mean by that is, it would you say, here's your options. Would you say, well, no, because the themes of Angels in America, we can apply them ourselves. We see today in them. Or do you think, like, I don't know, he might, Kushner might have a lot to say and actually create a part three that serves a purpose?
I don't think he should write a part three. I don't think he's going to write a part three either. I think he would rather like do anything but write a part three from
Well, that, those issues aside, that aside.
I don't I think it's I mean I think part one is pretty close to a perfect play, and you know, 40 years later, it's same stuff, different decade. You know, it's we're still experiencing the same things that he was writing about then. You know, he was so prescient, and Anne, in one of her multiple characters, as all the characters play multiple characters. I mean, she plays this young Republican who starts off the scene talking about we're going to take over Washington, and you know, we're going to take over the Supreme Courts, and the Oval Office will be ours forever. Why not? A permanent lock on it, and you know, now
I think it's
it's
my new
things
favorite monologue because it's so
is
I can
it so
feel
relevant?
whenever I start saying it, you can feel the air
It
like
just like
literally come
stuck
out
in.
of the room, and everybody's like, "Oh my God, like this has actually happened." It's awful.
By the way,
And
go ahead. Sorry.
no, you please.
Well, I was going to ask Anne, you know, because you play roles that are have been played by Faye Dunaway, Meryl Streep, and all that. Is there an? I'm just curious if there's an actor that you look at who say this is a role model for me.
I mean, obviously, you mentioned Meryl Streep. She's like she's the queen. But I also love like Kate Winslet as well too. She's my other probably kind of like acting role model. I think both of them are just so good at, you know, they become like I really admire actresses or actors in general that can become the other person, because I feel like a lot of times there's certain actors that get cast and it's like you're charming. I get why they kind of play that same person in just in like Matt Damon and different. No offense to Matt Damon, but Matt Damon and
Hey, I love Matt Damon.
He's a frequent listener, and you better watch
I
out.
know, right?
I just got a text from him.
Oh no.
he's lovely. He's lovely. Anyway, but I find them. I like the ones that are people that are like chameleons, where you're just kind of like you almost forget. Or like Daniel Day-Lewis does this a lot, right? Where it's just like you kind of forget he's Daniel Day-Lewis and everything that he does. Mm.
That's Dustin Hoffman for me, by the way.
Yeah.
You
just get okay. So now I just you made me want to ask everybody. You're all actors. So Brendan, who made you want to be an actor? Was there a, don't tell me that one's tough. Was there somebody you saw and went, I want to do this?
I gave this really dumb answer when I was in high school when my theater teacher asked me that, and I panicked. And I don't know why I said this, but I said Wayne Brady.
What are you, 12? What are you?
I guess so. I don't know. So I think for the sake of the bit, I may have to keep going with that for now. But yeah.
Well, Wayne Brady would be, he'd be like, wow, I'm glad I had that influence, you know.
Yeah.
Grant, how about you? Wayne Brady as well?
Actually, surprisingly not. Okay. I've been acting since, well, you know what it is. I've been acting since I was in first grade, and I wanted to start acting because of Judy Garland. And then as I grew older, it was Robin Williams and Meryl Streep and Dustin Hoffman. And then in post-grad, it's become Kate Blanchett and Patti LuPone and some other, Jesse Mueller, who I think is a brilliant stage actress.
And she's been on this show.
Hey, yeah, Chicago girly. Right. Yeah, I'm always going to gravitate, I think, a little bit more towards female actors because they're generally better than the male actors.
Yes.
In most things.
You didn't mention Tom Cruise. I mean, come on.
No, I didn't, and that was on purpose.
Okay. By the way, I have a theater collection, and you'd be might want to come over because I have Judy Garland's glove from her concert at the Palace.
Oh my! Brag about it.
It's on my piano. Sits on my piano. Joe, who influenced you?
So I would say growing up in my early performing was more geared towards comedy. So for me, early on, it's say like Jim Carrey, you know, Chris Farley, that type of stuff. And then as I've gotten older, I've just, you know, anytime I'll watch anything with Philip Seymour Hoffman in it over and over again. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of the pinnacle for me in terms of dramatic actors. Yeah.
Cool, Shane.
Yeah, Gene Wilder.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, that was my.
So you grew up wanting
for a long
to
time.
You grew up wanting to play this evil lawyer and well, but Gene Wilder.
I think it's his versatility that really probably lends itself to that. But I'd also say Paul Giamatti is another one that I really connect with.
Okay, yeah. I love it. I'll pick Jackie Gleason. I think he's amazing. And,
oh, yeah.
And Charles, when you cast shows, just out of curiosity, well, I don't know that you probably had somebody as maybe as a director or whatever. Who influenced you?
As a director or as an actor?
You can give me both.
Oh, my God. I love a lot of like, I love like the Japanese filmmakers a lot.
Kurosawa?
Like, Kurosawa and Mizoguchi and Ozu and like the Italian, like Fellini. And I just love film. And there are a lot of American directors as well. Like I Kubrick is not American, but I adore him, Coppola. Because I think the biggest thing is this: their sense of patience and the sense of just being like letting the story tell itself and just guiding it rather than trying to impose upon it. And I think that's something that they do so well. And trusting their audience as well too. I think a lot of people nowadays don't trust audiences. You know, who's going to do a 7-hour show about these really heady ideas? And you just have to trust that your audience is going to be there with you. So,
and my guess is your cast trusts you to help guide them through this process and get them where they need to be, which is amazing.
I trust them. So, yeah,
it's mutual.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, Grant, I also have a piece of music arranged by Judy Garland and signed by her. That's a separate thing.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Coming out my whole day.
But with that, let me encourage everybody who's with us now to see Angels in America at the Invictus Theater. Again, it's only until September September 7th. So you can't count on it going after that. But just in case you're out of town until then, the hope is it will extend to September 21st. And if you just go to InvictusTheaterCo.com, then you can see whether it's been extended. But if you go to VictorTheaterCo.com/angels, you can buy your tickets. And I suggest that you don't wait. Angels in America, one of the great shows. As soon as you announced it, Charles, as I said, it was in my calendar and I just couldn't wait. And look, now here it is. It's already here.
You know what's funny, Paul? You asked me when we were doing the network interview, you're like, what are you doing next year? And I was like, I can't tell you, but you're really gonna like it.
And you were right. And I'm assuming next season it'll be a Kurosawa thing or something like that coming up. So
who knows? Next year, I have no idea.
Anyway, my thanks to all of you for giving me your time. I appreciate it so very much. And hopefully you will step in the shoes of all those who have influenced you. But for now, break legs every night in Angels in America. Thanks for joining me here in Behind the Curtain. And we'll see you all next time for joining us. Break legs, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.